Okay. World War II has just ended. We're now addressing leftover bits of World War II as well as the post-war Cold War period. And on the sheets, there was a request to identify what 109's initials were. WACs are what? Chicks in the Navy, right? No, in the Army. Women in the Army.
Is that the acronym?
Yeah. Women's something corps. Army corps. I don't know. They all stand for something. I wish I knew. Being the one getting paid for it, I really wish I had.
In the Army, though?
Yeah.
That means we have no idea what WAVE is doing.
It's Navy.
Women in the Navy?
And SPARs, I'm not sure. I think SPARs were in the Marines, but they were also sometimes nicknamed BAMs for abroad Marines. That's actually a 1940s phrase, broad-ass Marines, was the nickname for SPARs. How come we don't have WACs, WAVs, and SPARs now?
Because the services are all
integrated. Because they're integrated.
Well, except for most services don't allow women in certain combat roles.
Do you think any of these were involved in count combat roles?
No.
Probably not.
Women's
Army Corps. How about WAVs and SPARs?
That doesn't matter. Although you did leave off the WASP.
It's just women's history, not like it's going to come up on the AP test.
That's like the most likely thing to come up on the AP.
But seriously speaking, with this, what would you, if you said to what degree did women have a role in World War II? Say the question was, what was the impact on, or what was the role of any of the following three groups in World War II, and it's African American women and say Mexican.
Or that one that said compare the 1920s to 1950s in these areas, you can do.
They might compare one in World War I and World War
II. Is women accepted for volunteer emergency service?
Is it Navy?
Yes.
Okay.
What's
SPARS.
And you left off the WASP.
WASP.
Accepted for volunteer.
White Anglo-Saxon Protestant chicks?
No. Women's Air Service pilots.
Was there really a WASP?
It was
United Coast Guard, Women's Reserve.
Okay, so SPARS is Coast Guard? I thought it's Marines. And maybe Marines was just BAMS.
What's the next one?
BAMS.
Oh, you're not going to find that one. BAMS.
Wikipedia.
I'm not showing it.
Wait, what was that?
I'm going to have to Google
WAVs,
that.
Women accepted for
volunteer emergency service. Mm-hmm.
But what does it collectively all show? That women were involved in the war effort, but in segregated facilities. So they did have a role not only in manufacturing war goods, as Rosie the Riveter, but they also played a role in being able to contribute directly to the military. No BAMs?
No.
Probably not politically correct for an AP test anyway.
Admiral Lagasse.
Oh. 110, I believe we did. 111, I think we did. So we're at 112, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. A series of conferences, which included Tehran and Yalta, and as well as one in Washington, D.C. suburbs, Dumbarton Oaks. The details and the structure of the United Nations was crafted and put together. And finally, on April 12, 1945, the day FDR died, in San Francisco, the UN Charter was signed by all member nations and officially began on that date. And the United Nations, we talked about how it differed from the League of Nations in regards to security, with the Security Council and the veto vote.
Did you say died?
FDR. The creator of it. FDR. The UN consists of these bodies: the General Assembly, the Secretariat, the Security Council, the International Court of Justice. There are other agencies, but those are the major roles. The General Assembly is where everybody's represented in a most democratic fashion.
That's where Hugo Chavez shows up and smells the salt.
Yeah. The Secretariat is the agency that keeps up with the paperwork and administrative activities. Security Council is the peacekeeping aspect, and I think the International Court of Justice is obvious.
Although the U.S. doesn't recognize it.
What five nations were the first and still are the permanent Security Council members?
U.S., France, Germany, Russia, and China.
Okay, and why are those chosen?
We won the second one.
Yeah, okay.
U.S., Britain.
That's
it, yes. So the good guys of World War II get to forever keep the peace.
Okay. That's Germany. But not this. They lost.
Are we familiar with what the GI Bill of Rights, or as it's formerly called, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, does? Here's an interesting question, one that we shouldn't waste time on. Let's say a veteran is fighting in Europe or fighting in Japan and risks or does suffer injury, or someone is someone who works a desk in Wisconsin throughout World War II.
They both get that, don't they?
They both get it, don't they? Do they both deserve it?
Yes.
Because that person working the desk job, if he doesn't work his desk job, well, other people in the theater could.
So they all gave up of the years that could have been in private business and going to college. But is one definitely more deserving of the risk factors that would it entail?
No.
So let's say we have something called affirmative action. And say African Americans were enslaved for many years, but women also had some problems, and the Native Americans had some. Isn't the African American experience far more deserving of some kind of adjustment and rebalancing of fairness in society?
Yeah.
So then why do other minorities get affirmative action help?
Can I get
clarity? We're still reading.
The United States is so good at oppressing people that we oppress.
So is that a bad parallel? All veterans deserve some compensation for their losses, even if some had bigger risks and losses than others? Or is that just bad to make those kind of parallels?
How could they be like, oh, you lost a leg, that's worth a full ride for 4 years. Oh, you just worked through that job, that's worth a semester.
So you were a woman who came from the Vanderbilt family, and you had your relatives all in slavery, but you were all oppressed?
No.
Oh.
Number
115. There's no answer to any of that. It's just regardless if it's not exactly fair, why is the GI Bill of Rights beneficial to all of society? Or is it?
Well, it increases the income level.
It decreases the new workforce.
Cool. So it filtered people back into society slowly with the economy.
Said that we slowly?
Well, that was the Truman's efforts in America. To make sure that you don't fall right back into depression.
But wasn't that some guy wrote a book or something that she told us or something?
Probably. MacArthur, what did he do from 1951 through 1953, although he wasn't there anymore from 52 to 53?
Well, Japan.
I should have said 45 to 51. Yeah,
He was the occupier of Japan.
And while they may not ask a lot about it, do you know anything much about MacArthur's occupation of Japan? What he attempted to do, what he succeeded to do?
Well, they snuck him out before.
That's back in 1940.
Or that.
So now, when the war is over and the bombs have been dropped and Japan has surrendered and he accepts the surrender aboard the Missouri on September 2nd, so starting September 3rd onward, from 1945 through 51, and the reason I stopped there is because he sent off to fight in Korea. What things occur during MacArthur's occupation of post-war Japan?
They build schools.
There's a rebuilding program. In many ways, it's like reconstruction of the South, except it's more positive and more successful.
That's right.
They try to rebuild Japan that is destroyed, but they not only rebuild the infrastructure, they also do things Japan had not known. They create labor unions, they give women the right to vote, they liberalize Japan to move it away from its fascist past. Here's another very controversial but interesting aspect. MacArthur demands that the emperor declare himself not divine. The emperor had always been traditionally believed by the Japanese people to have been descendant of the sun god Amaterasu, that the sun goddess mated with a mortal, and those offsprings continue to mate with mortals, and although you water down the blood, you still have a little spark of sun goddess in there somewhere. Why did MacArthur demand that the emperor deny that story and say, no, he's just, all his relatives are just humans?
Because then it removes some of his power.
Either that or because he wanted to sell Christianity's religion.
So where you have to believe in another person descending from God, is that? Or should I not say that on tape? So I'll repeat my comment so it's possible to believe that somebody else descended from God, some human. Is that the purpose of the content?
But
the theory of descending from God is not so wrong, just wrong place where it happened.
But it gives them, and not, you know, Jesus.
It gives the deity the power to run the country without someone coming and, you know, saying, why don't we have the God run the country?
Yeah, if we ignore the whole Christian part of the discussion, which maybe you could put in there, but I think the main purpose is if the emperor is just a human like everybody else, then that ends this fanatical worship of the emperor as somebody that can't be touched, somebody that can't be... You know, one of the reasons the Japanese government was reluctant to surrender for a long time was the fear that the emperor would be put on trial for war crimes. And they had promised to Casablanca what?
That he would be put on trial.
They promised nothing at Casablanca. No conditions. It's unconditional surrender. If we decide later to put him on trial for war crimes, that's just the way it is, because there's no conditions given to you. When you surrender, it's to surrender because you have no choice. So that's why the Japanese were real reluctant to surrender, for fear that the emperor would be mistreated.
So is that the way that he got him to...
Well, what they did was, they when they accepted the surrender, that he knew then well to keep the peace and keep the country well behaved, don't even touch the emperor for a while. So this approaching the emperor on de-deification was something he did after the occupation was working well and smooth and through voluntary cooperation, and the emperor was willing to do it. Because he was a man of modern-day science and knew it wasn't true either.
But he didn't mind people thinking it was true.
I think he recognized that was a way of making up for the past. By taking away that status, no longer could people say, gee, if we could have only won the war with our reverend emperor. I mean, the need for the war was finally made wrong. Another aspect of MacArthur's occupation was the demonopolizing of the Zaibatsu, Zaibatsu. I know it's not on there, but it's good stuff. The Zaibatsu was the five big families of Japanese economics: Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo. I'm thinking Yamaha was one, but these big names that make everything from pianos and cherry pies to motorcycles. There were five big families in Japan that owned and ran everything in a very corporate state fascistic manner. And MacArthur forced them to sell off their holdings like an anti-monopoly law. And I think in 1957 they turned around and made it legal to recombine. Japan likes monopolies. So that was an aspect of his occupation.
If you look at it today, Mitsubishi does make everything straight pies and
televisions. Yeah. So that was another aspect. But the ultimate purpose of an occupation of Japan was to do what?
Liberalize
it, democratize it, rebuild it in a modern day, make the world safer democracy. Not crush them, not destroy them like they did Germany, but make them in a country like ourselves so they can be good cooperative neighbors forever.
So that ain't permanently take away their power to make war.
That's the last part of my country. But also, if they are good democratic capitalists like us, they won't become friends of the
communist
Russians. So they're... We go on that theory that they dropped the bombs in a hurry to keep Russian occupation out, and now they're rebuilding Japan in such a way so they'll be Cold War allies against Russia. But what you
did that happen?
Yeah, it did. Worked out well. In fact, they got to be better capitalists than we for a while, didn't they? Making and selling things.
They still are.
What?
Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution.
Anti-Mecklenburg.
You're thinking of the thing I told you before that Evan Mecklenburg said? About the height of people. I'm not going to repeat that at this point.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to repeat that. Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution outlaws war. The Japanese nation can never engage in war again.
Well, it's except in self-defense.
Does it say that?
And they're allowed to have self-defense forces.
Well, they have a self-defense force, but did they say in the article already an exception?
They can defend themselves.
The Japanese Constitution.
Like, while we're in occupying Afghanistan, we can defend ourselves? Okay.
Should I go pull it up?
Yeah.
I think it says, like, if a foreign country invades in there, they're right to find out.
Like, check it out. What was the intent of making such an article in their constitution?
So every country could attack them?
So this is the Japanese constitution, not like the U.S.
No, the 1945 new rebuilt
Japanese constitution. So Japan's never a threat?
That's it. So they could convince their neighbors. We were horrible in World War II, but we'll never do that again. We're apologizing for what we did. Now let us sell you Hondas and Toyotas. I'm being sarcastic, but that's they knew that to ever get a good business relationship with their neighbors again, they would have to convince people that they're not the war-making power there was.
So did they demilitarize it?
They did demilitarize down to, they've built back up a self-defense force, but they call it a police force. But your point is well taken, and that is, if you outlaw war and completely demobilize, thus you'd have to spend money on the military and have a better economy, who's going to protect you?
Your neighbor will outlaw war, and you won't need it.
As long as the U.S. did, and still does, guarantee protection of Japan, it's a pretty good move, isn't it? Even last summer, when North Korea was shooting off those missiles and threatening to attack Japan, we were still the defenders of Japan at that point in time. You found it yet?
Yeah, just read the Article 7 real quick. The kind of residual powers that the emperor has. He can dissolve the House of Representatives.
So he's kind of like a constitutional monarchy type thing?
Yeah, he still has some power. Like, he dissolved the parliament or something like that.
How democratic are they today?
Parliamentary democratic, yeah. Like European parliamentary systems, they are democratic. They tend to have one prominent political party called the, who is it? The LDP, Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, is the dominant party that usually wins all the elections. There's a number of all third and fourth and fifth parties, but they always have to make coalitions to even get anywhere close to pulling the other party.
Did they get pluralities? Or did they make the coalitions and they have to get majorities?
I don't know. I really don't know that much about Japanese politics.
I think their current forces are unconstitutional.
Their what forces?
It says, aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes.
Get down.
Two, in order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potentials, will never be maintained.
Even though they do have a pretty big police force right now?
Well, no, they have the Japanese air self-defense forces and sea self-defense forces.
But I think they call them police forces, so they're not military.
They're policing themselves, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, it says international.
And then it says, yeah, the right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized.
So, you can see the flavor of when that was... Does it give a year? Was it 45 or 46? Or?
Let me go
all
the way down to the bottom. November 3rd, 1946 was 46. The day of the signing of the Silver Emperor.
And this was not something the U.S. forced upon them. They themselves came up with this suggestion, and MacArthur was glad to accept it. Let's go to 116.
So they made it while they were being occupied, though?
Mm-hmm. I probably, if I was doing this correctly, should do 120 first. Chronologically, 116 is, I guess, the next thing that comes along. Well, let's do 120 for a second, and then 120 will make it all make sense, because I think that's a thesis foundation here. Let's talk a little bit about World War II. I'm going to pose a question which I hope you will answer pretty thoroughly. The reason that we in the USSR got on the same side of the war is because we were such great buddies in the 20s and 30s.
No.
Good trading partners and had the same political system.
No.
Talk about that for a while.
The enemy of mine.
Yeah. Before World War II started, what was the differences in relationship between U.S. and Russia?
Well, the U.S. had actually invaded Russia to try to put down the Bolshevik Rebellion.
From 1918 to 1921, that didn't sit well. What else is true about the difference in our nations between 20s and 30s?
Well, that and the political system, there's actually a small red scare in the U.S.
Why?
Because they feel all the labor unions were communists who were going over to the government.
Who? So relate that to Russia.
20 car-carrying communists.
So relate that back to Russia.
Well, Russia's communist.
Okay, so in other words, what I'm saying, in the early 20s, Russia seems to be the greatest threat to us. Did they stop being communist in the 20s and
30s? They're probably one of the biggest world powers.
So under Stalin, they became even more severely communist, didn't they?
Yeah, but the thing is, we need them to stay in the war to keep that Eastern front.
I'm still comparing the two nations here. So they've become ever more entrenched, harder Marxist communists in the 20s and 30s. What do we do in the 20s and 30s?
We become rich capitalist people.
In the 20s. Then in the 30s?
We have a depression.
FDR cleans it out.
Oh, and Russia didn't have a separate from the depression.
Well, they kind of suffered from a continuous depression from 1914 to 1989. But
yeah.
But
well, the difference I'm getting at is that in the 20s, we're ideologically way on the opposite end. In the 30s, Republicans like to say what about Democrats in relation to Russia?
They're coming to make
them. They're creeping closer. They're running dog fellows. These liberal Democrats would like to be full-blown socialists and maybe even communists given the chance. Then we get into, by the mid to late 30s, what brings us, not together, becomes a common cause. Yeah. What's the common cause between us?
Fighting fascism.
Being threatened by Germany. And Germany does declare war on us right after Pearl Harbor. And what have they already done to Russia?
They've already invaded Russia.
So during the war, now we find ourselves both at war with Germany. How are relations with Germany with Russia during the war?
Right.
Fairly good. Yeah. Right. In fact, we are feeding them a lot of Lend-Lease. Without our Lend-Lease, they couldn't stay in, but also without the 20 to 30 million dead Russians, we'd have lost the war.
Yeah, because they have to keep Beecher in front of them.
And in fact, soldiers meet at the Elbe River, in April of 1945, and that's supposed to have been the best time that Russian-American relations were all the way up until the 1980s, as they were collectively together going to defeat Germans. So when Hitler dies and Germany surrenders, what do you think then is the relationship between Russia and ourselves?
Deteriorates
instantly. Rewards.
That's it. The deteriorate in post-war policy, because now there's no common threat, and we begin to remember that they're still commies, and they remember we're still capitalists. So there is a fundamental difference between us, and then there is what's going to happen to the post-war Europe.
It's going to be split up into spheres of influence.
Okay. What's true about everything east of Germany and Austria?
It's going to be communist.
It's under Russian control. Why is it under Russian control?
Because Russia, they've got troops there.
In the counterattack to take over Germany, they ran over all of Eastern Europe and stayed there. This is some of the reason that Churchill had his soft underbelly strategy. Churchill argued we ought to be coming up through the east also, so that we have equal voice over Eastern European governments and they don't all fall under just Russian control. So that's one of the reasons he didn't want to invade France, is to check Russia's power. And it's accurate. Russians do have control all over Eastern Europe, and they will keep control of Eastern European governments under puppet communist dictatorships to win.
The 80s?
89, 90. So what Churchill warned did come true. And then, of course, Germany is a special case itself, because Germany will be split into separate occupation zones, and Berlin itself will also be split into separate zones. Eventually, as we'll see in the story here, they are recombined into a West and East Germany. West is capitalist, East is communist, and there'll be a West and East Berlin the same way, too.
Although Berlin is kind of in the middle of the Eastern Germany.
When did Germany become Germany?
That's the Jerry Lewis Dean Martin reunion. That's 1990, isn't it? You guys are around, aren't you? When the hell were you born? Surely not 1990.
Yeah, 90s.
So you don't remember when they shot Kennedy, huh?
No, not quite.
The men came in and we all did it.
Well, yeah, so it was 1989, 1990 when the wall came down. I'm used to having people remember this.
No, I was born in 90.
Well, when they put you in the little car seat and stuck in front of the television to entertain you, don't you remember all the wall coming down?
No, I wasn't born then.
I have seen recordings of news.
I was alive one evening then, so...
Well, yeah, it's nice. Now I see why the Cold War means so little to people. It really never happened during
the
war.
We didn't
live
it,
so.
Yeah.
We're still living
it. In Germany, though, it was never ever.
When I first started teaching, Vietnam just ended.
Whoa.
So that's far kind of hard for me.
Mr. Jones?
What?
The Cold War should kind of be important things. We're still living it.
The Cold War?
Yes.
It tends to try to resurface with people like Putin.
Well, that, and there's still the constant threat of nuclear annihilation.
But not from communist, non-communist forces.
Oh, well,
no, it's from renegade forces that pick up the material.
Renegade communist forces.
Don't feel it like they did.
Not Russia.
The action. The new action.
So what we get in at 120 is there is an outbreak of tension between the Soviets and ourselves as we no longer have the same common threat. We see each other as the common threat. Will the Russians become the new Nazis? Will they become the dictatorial force that we have to check just like the Nazis? And they're thinking, here's the Russian thinking. Twice in this century, capitalists, they may have been Germans, but capitalists invaded our country and killed millions of our people. How do we prevent ourselves from being threatened by the new capitalists, Britain, France, and America?
by spreading communism.
By keeping all of Eastern Europe under Russian control, by building a buffer zone. So the one argument is the Russians build these occupation governments to protect themselves from further invasion from capitalists. But our view of looking at why they're all over Eastern Europe is because
they're
the new aggressors. They're the new Nazis. They're going to take over all of Europe and the world. So both see each other as a threat, and that cooperative war period is now gone, and most of everything that takes place in foreign policy from about 1946-47 to about 1990, or at least 85, can be traced somewhere back to the tensions of the Soviet-American relations. So when we talk about these individual items in these teams here, you can usually trace it back to Cold War origin, such as the 1947 National Security Act. I'm reminded of the Homeland Security Act when I see that. In 1947, Congress passed a law which did the following. It took the Navy Department and the War Department and fused them into one department called
Department of Defense?
DOD, Department of Defense today.
Have a nice spin to that name.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons the name was chosen is because the Russians had a defense ministry and they said, and the Americans have a War Department. So who's the aggressor? Look at the names. So we changed away from war to defense. Most of the course, I talk about secretaries of war, not defense. So I still think of Rumsfeld as secretary of war.
Well, did you see that article? I think it was on the Onion. Strom Thurmond choosing his cabinet. Who he wants for a secretary of war.
That's pretty good. Wish you could print that again. There was also the creation of the CIA, which had been during World War II, the OSS.
Office of
Strategic
Services.
What is the CIA now?
Central Intelligence Agency.
What's its purpose?
To create intelligence.
Spy. It's an espionage spy agency. We never had a spy agency in peacetime before. It was only in wartime did we have them. We disbanded them when the wars were over. Why would we keep a... not only keep it alive, but change it and make it bigger and more fun.
Because we have to keep abreast of the communist threat.
Yeah, that's it. It's this permanent threat from the Russians. I mean, we can't demobilize, we can't... So the non-demobilization of World War II has multiple purposes. Not only does it not flood a lot of people into the unemployment situation, but it also keeps us defended. If we had stayed well defended from between the two world wars, would we have been safer maybe? That's the thinking.
Well... Germany, I thought, oh, wait, they're going to kill us as soon as we cross the Rhine.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good parallel. That we did not stand up to German threats in the 30s. Now we will stand up to Russian potential threats in the 40s and 50s. It created a separate air force because there had been naval and army air forces. Now it's going to be a separate force. And it creates what's called the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in which each member of, whether it's Army, Navy, Marines.
We just got new Army Chiefs of Staff.
Would meet together, and also members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if I'm correct. No, I'm not. I'm lying. Didn't know that.
What were you going to say?
I'll say it while I was talking about the National Security Council.
Oh, you're...
But the National Security Act creates a National Security Council, which will have a National Security Advisor. Who was that National Security Advisor? Who was it before?
It was Condoleezza Rice.
That's
but
right.
She was replaced by some nameless bureaucrat.
It's a white guy.
I know. It's a nameless white guy, but yeah. Bush administration.
Previous famous national security advisors who became secretaries of state include Henry Kissinger and someone else. But Colin Powell. He was national security advisor for Bush the Elder and then became secretary of state for Bush the Younger.
What is it called, the national security what?
Advisor.
The group. Council.
Before we go on who's in that council, let's ask this question. What's the role of the National Security Advisor that should be different from the Department of Defense or Department of State?
The domestic national security.
Is that what it is?
Defense is when we're in war.
Well, domestic...
The way you explained it, I love, because you're making it sound like National Security Advisor protects the nation, Department of Defense invades other nations.
Or no, the Department of Defense looks to outside threats, National Security Advisor looks to... the subversives, the terrorism.
Is it possible that we just have some bureaucratic duplication going on?
Yeah, it's very possible.
Okay, and when we created Homeland Security and still have a National Security Advisor and a Department of Defense and a Department of State.
And an Intel Czar.
Yes. I hate the Czar thing. Yeah.
What?
We have an Intel Czar and a drug Czar.
A Czar?
Czar sounds so undemocratic.
Well, he's not actually called that. He's like the director of intelligence or something like that. Just some position is created to govern all the...
But what theme am I hinting at, both in 1947 and in 2000, whenever, 4 or 5?
That is, instead of creating new groups, just...
We grow the government bureaucracy. Government grows larger and larger despite people's wishes to shrink government in response to world situations, especially defense.
And
every time we're scared into defense, whether it's war on terror or war on Russians... There is a movement to build more and more bureaucracy to cope with it.
If you shrink the government, then you lose jobs. Like every
bureaucrat
has a thousand.
That's a good point. Not only do we build something to cope with an outside threat, but we create a permanent bureaucracy and more government spending and hiring.
Doesn't the NSA also create the NSA?
National Security
Act versus National Security Agency.
Did I not say that?
It's not on there.
Well, that's right. The National Security
Agency... It's under the CIA, though.
Yeah, I got left off, but there is a National Security Council, and that council does include the advisor, but it also includes the president, the vice president, and all of these members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They all meet in this council. So watch West Wing.
Yes.
When
Until
Bartlett would come and sit in the big board...
The situation room.
Situation room. That was always meeting with the National Security Council. And what's interesting here, for the first time since the Constitution, if I'm telling the truth here, I think the first time since the Constitution was built, the Vice President was given a statutory job.
Isn't he also the Administrator, or does it have something to do with NASA?
When he became the leader of the Senate? Or?
That's in the Constitution, right?
Oh.
Preside over the Senate.
Yeah. Oh.
But being on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or being on the National Security Advisor, means the Vice President would be in on the know of things.
Be on the National Security Advisor.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is no longer would a vice president be kept at arm's length from a president. Now they're being involved in foreign policy decisions.
But didn't you just say that the National Security Council was a duplicate of something?
Mm-hmm.
What was it a duplicate of?
Joint Chief of Staff, I'd say. I mean, when the same people are serving on both.
So he's not on the Joint Chief of Staff?
No,
no, that's just
security.
So they could just drink coffee and eat donuts during the National Security Council meetings and then keep them out of the loop.
And then
catch the
tape later of what was said.
I think the purpose of the National Security Council is to integrate the Joint Chiefs of Staff with the civilian command and control authorities.
Well, what I'm really trying to do is build the opportunity for a cheap shot, so let me use it here. And that is, when Bush the Elder arrested Noriega for drug money in 1989 or 90, whenever it was, he himself had said on the National Security Council back in the mid-80s when they talked about using Noriega as a CIA operative, knowing that he was selling drugs at the time. So if he was on the council that approved of the use of Noriega as a CIA operative when he was selling drugs then, why did he act all surprised later in 1990 and 91 that he's a drug seller?
Because he wasn't working in the CIA.
So he was a useful operative in the 80s, and then later when we don't need him anymore because he threatens the Panama Canal's ownership.
He wasn't our son of a bitch anymore.
That's it. That's what I'm looking at. And could the same be said about bin Laden?
Yeah.
Bin Laden was useful in the Afghan war against the Russians. Not so useful right now.
That's head of the Mujahideen.
Mm-hmm. On with this. 117, the Taft-Hartley Act, or the Management Labor Relations Act of 1947. Here is its multiple functions. It outlawed closed shops. Did we ever talk about that in the labor discussion? Or the AFL discussion?
I think you may have talked about
it.
You know what a closed shop law is?
Everyone has to join the union.
In a state, if you work in that given business, the law is you have to join the union in order to get the job and stay in the union to keep the job. Arkansas does not have closed shop laws. It has what's called right-to-work laws, which means you're not compelled to be a union member to work at the given factory. What are the arguments for and against closed shop laws?
Well, it gives the union greater voice to represent all of the workers in a closed shop, but in a closed shop it also prevents people that wouldn't go on strike from working.
Mm-hmm. So it takes away choice of liberty to be forced to join the union?
Instead of being forced to join the Communist Party?
Some degree. And then the other argument made back the other way is that right-to-work laws are misnamed. They should be called right-to-work-for-less laws because that's what's going to happen if you're not in the union. So those are the arguments. So if in 1947, it would help if we remember this. Remember I talked about in the 1930s, organized labor became the friend of and was boosted by the Democrats under the New Deal?
Yeah.
many people thought that the Democrats were just bending over backwards too far and helping organized labor have too much voice, and that there needs to be a reeling in of too much organized labor power. What's wrong with giving unions more voice and power?
Because then they'll just go on strike every week, and that's going to be a difference.
That's how it fits the Cold War. That weren't unions always the breeding grounds for radicals and leftists? Weren't union organizers always those Eastern European immigrants with accents?
Yeah.
That was all. Or if they're not that, they're mafia friends. In the 40s and 50s, they get looked at that way. So unions and union leaders were always looked at with askance, and maybe they've become too powerful, and their power needs to be reeled back in by a more conservative Congress. After FDR dies under Truman, Republicans start to gain control of Congress. That's why they pass over Truman's veto, the Taft-Hartley Act. So it outlawed closed shops.
Who vetoed this?
Truman, and it was passed over his veto. It gave the president the authority to call for a 60-day cooling-off period in the case of a strike.
May I make a comment?
Yeah.
That something isn't on these liquor sheets.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't Truman the first president to be governed by the 22nd Amendment?
Actually not. Eisenhower was. If you look at the 22nd Amendment, it says, not counting the current sitting dude. Maybe it's not so sexist to say dude. I think it's a president. I think it says the current sitting president
is
his
example.
Well, you want to read it to us? It's in the back. It's the stop me before I choose to vote again amendment.
Yeah.
Take away my free choice amendment. Right? If we finally get a good president, make sure I can't have him more than twice.
What was the part about union shops?
Oh, a good president twice, though, doesn't mean he'll be a good president the third time.
No president shall be elected to the office of president more than
spouses.
Twice.
A good spouse for 2 years doesn't mean she'll be a good spouse for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, it says section
one. Say it again.
Section one, no person shall be elected to the office of president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected. Elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. But this article shall not apply to any person holding the office of president when the article was proposed by Congress, and shall not prevent any person who may be holding the office of president or acting as president during the term within this article becomes operative from holding the office of president or is acting from president during the remainder of such term.
Who's hired to write that?
You know what someone said once?
Actually, he would still be
on
that.
Your most important sentences when you're writing should be short. And all the stuff that's not important should be long.
Journalistic language.
No, that's not journalism. That's English.
This isn't legalese.
Legalese is totally different. Well, so the point is that Truman was never under that amendment.
He was under it.
How?
Because it only says that it will not prevent him from serving out his current term.
I think it said he could run as many times as he wanted.
No,
it
didn't.
I think it did.
It said this does not apply to
U.S.
office.
Said, if I can find it again. That's the first amendment.
I wonder if this is true in his cabinet. Can I run?
It says, during the term within which this article becomes operative from holding office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term.
Didn't it say earlier it does not apply? He's cherry picking on us here.
No, it didn't say that.
Well, did he want to run a third
term? If he had ran a third time,
then it would
probably
have been.
Someone probably would have been like, well, you can't do that.
My general impression of the amendment was that Truman was not held at the standard, but that he wouldn't have, as you said, wanted to anyway.
But he was held at the standard.
He probably would have known it by the time he ran.
Maybe if we're going to talk about this amendment, why did the amendment come into existence?
Because FDR ran 4 times.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
Ran once.
Yes, I like that.
Oh,
it was chosen by the people. Reluctantly still answered the call of the people.
Even though he was about to die.
And in fact, spent his last breath serving the people.
Probably even was voted for by the
people.
How do you get all this money?
The Roosevelt family in the 1820s and 30s was one of many that sold drugs to China.
Opium people.
Yeah. Wasn't the only source of their money, but
basically, yeah, the British fighting for the right to keep sell drugs to China.
So the union shop part, just ignore that. I think it'd be easier. Just don't ask what the word union shop means. It's probably unlikely it would be on a test. 60-day cooling off period was given to the president in the case of a strike. So say the union say, we are threatening to go on strike next week. The president could say, you can't do it for 2 months. Why would they give the president the authority to prevent a strike? That's really
that
bad
labor.
That way
they can't start national security critical production.
Yeah, that's it. See, back in the 30s, the government would have been on the side of protecting strikers. But now in the late 40s, during the Cold War, this association that unions are somewhat left-leaning, there's this idea that unions would threaten our security by going on strike when we need to be ready to fight commies. So the president could delay that. And, of course, the hopes would be that during the period in the 60 days, the president is using his power of the office to mediate, negotiate between two sides to come up with a settlement. The Taft-Hartley Act also said that anybody who is a labor leader and a communist has to fess up.
Are you serious?
Yes.
But people were coming around the pond tonight.
Well, it's kind of a first cousin to the fact that during the Truman years, they also mandated loyalty oaths of all federal employees, that you had to guarantee, you'd sign, yes, I am not a member of the Communist Party if I work at the federal government.
What if you signed, yes, I am a member?
Then they'd have you for breaking a federal law.
That's kind of like bringing the pot in the tax stamps.
Yeah. So both the Taft-Hartley Act and these loyalty oaths demanded during the years of Truman. See, a lot of people think this crap all starts under McCarthy in the 50s, but it's already going on in the Truman years of the 40s.
You couldn't be a member of the Communist Party and work for the government. Mm-hmm. It'd be breaking the law.
Breaking the loyalty oaths law.
Is there in the freedom of religion? Like,
it's freedom of speech, I think. Freedom of assembly.
Okay, right. But like, where you have the right to choose religion,
Communism. You
not have a right to choose a political party.
The argument that was made in the, I think it's 1950, Smith, Dennis versus the U.S. case, Dennis versus the U.S. case, was that since communism and socialism by its very nature advocates the violent overthrow of the government, to be a member of that organization automatically means you're endangering and threatening the government of sedition. I think that's how they ruled it. The same argument's being used right now about if you're a member of a terrorist organization, like Hamas or something like that, you cannot officially be a member of that organization in America because you're therefore threatening the overthrow of the U.S. government. You do not have the First Amendment right legally to be a member of Al-Qaeda in America or Hamas.
So did we during the Cold War, did we have relations with Russia like at all? Or would
we did. We had diplomats. Both were exchanged. And we kept in touch with each other. In fact, while you mention that, because the Cuban Missile Crisis almost led to war the way it did, what quicker means of communications between two nations is established.
Well, they put in the hotline in the Pentagon.
The hotline, yeah. The phone so that in case there is missiles on a screen looking dangerous or like planes looking dangerous, you can get on the phone and call directly to the premier or to the president and talk this thing over rather than have to fight the diplomats.
Well, or in that case, call the Pentagon, then it might be routed to the president.
Mm. Now, and the two executives, or are executives allowed to do that? Like,
call each other directly?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're...
I think it still exists.
But...
It does.
Congress can is the only one that can declare war, right?
Wow. Well, you just walked into a quagmire there. He's asked the classic Cold War question. If, according to the Constitution, only Congress can declare war, how did presidents without any congressional declaration drag us into the Korean War and the Vietnam War and all the other small skirmishes?
Supposedly their power as commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
That was just an accepted thing. The bipartisan policy made it such that the fear of Russians and the communists was so bad that presidents need to be given leeway and access to defend us in an emergency. And then when we got really stuck in Vietnam, they began to say, how did we get stuck in there? Because we gave presidents too much authority. So that's why they passed, 1973
War Powers Act?
Yeah, it's called the War Powers Act. It's really worth looking at.
Well, that obviously didn't help us anything.
Do we have the 25th Amendment? Do we have the 25th Amendment on our Cold War stuff?
Don't tell me what it is. I can remember this. 24th is poll tax. 25th is ascendancy, right?
Succession of the presidency.
Which is related to Eisenhower's heart attack and Kennedy getting shot?
No, it's kind of related to
it is, isn't
what
it?
Happens if
business related.
Yeah, everyone killed at once.
Yeah, so in what he's saying about the 25th Amendment, about the new redefined, more clearly defined presidential succession amendment, it was based on a heart attack by Eisenhower in 56 and the shooting of Kennedy. If Kennedy or Eisenhower had not died but had remained in a vegetative state, who would have had the authority to run the country and get on the hot phone and send missiles? It would have been unclear. That's why that amendment was passed.
Some people claim that it has something to do with, say, Washington is destroyed and all the people are there except for, like, the Secretary of Agriculture.
That's true, too.
The country.
That's true, too.
Isn't that kind of showing how powerful the president is? What if all of Congress blew up? Well, what do we do then?
It'd be screwed.
Aren't they just as important?
Yeah,
don't forget your question. In the minds of the founding fathers, yes. But in the reality of the Cold War, when there needs to be one executive who can move quickly, I think
wouldn't agree. Yeah, most states governors can appoint replacements.
You have a good point there. Yes.
When did they start the practice of keeping the vice president and the president separate a lot?
Well, they don't really keep the president and vice president separate, like Secretary of the Union. They keep like a cabinet secretary.
You mean in the danger of what he just talked about, of an attack?
Well,
I think what you're alluding to is during the State of the Union address, one cabinet member cannot attend. They have to stay back.
Yeah, stuff like that.
I don't know when they started, but it sure sounds to me like this is the period when they would do it, the Cold War period.
Oh, although it's a good idea now because of the terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a set rotation of who can attend? Or
president
is it just
chooses.
Like,
no. Or it's like whoever just can't attend for some reason. So you're the designated president sometimes.
Are you West Wing fans?
Awesome.
Are you West Wing fans?
I remember that episode.
The episode where the president chooses the Secretary of Agriculture to stay, and he says to him, kind of giving a quick advice, if we all get killed and you become president, he says, do you have a best friend? He says, yes. Is he smarter than you? Yes, that's your chief of staff. That's an interesting statement.
Who said that?
Bartlett said that to the Secretary of Agriculture.
The best president ever.
What a different world it would be.
What if Aaron Sorkin?
Did you notice what they did with... just fast forward past this. What they did on West Wing towards the last season... They showed Bartlett's multiple sclerosis getting out of hand, and so he was wheelchair bound, and all these obvious references to FDR were being placed upon President Bartlett to make him look so much like it. It's well done.
Cool.
One. It's worth having all
like
seven
it.
Or nine.
Do you have the season set?
I
have
the season set. During the season finale.
Really?
I kept distracting my mom.
I've got them all on DVD.
Do you have the original?
Like
I've only seen like the past two seasons.
The
okay, here we are. 118.
We've almost done
another aspect of post-World War II policy is the occupation of Germany, which we said was talked about in Tehran more firmly defined in Yalta and finally completed at the Potsdam Conference. Germany would be divided in first into three zones, a Russian zone, a British zone, an American zone, and the Russians would not agree to a French zone. Eventually, a French zone was created by the British and the Americans surrendering some of their land for such. Berlin was also broken into separate occupation zones. By 1949, they became two separate nations. The Russian zone became East Germany. All the Western zones became United West Germany.
Okay, was East Germany the Democratic Republic of Germany?
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was the Federal Democratic Republic?
When you ever hear the word Democratic Republic of anything, it means commie.
Or, no, that's People's Republic.
Both. Both means commie.
I like People's
Federated Republic of Germany was
the
West Germany, which means capitalism.
Well, People's Republic of China, People's Republic of North Korea.
Well, what about Democratic Republic of Congo?
It means commie.
People's Republic of California.
Or Massachusetts.
So,
that's the one.
Germany was divided into these four zones, and what does that mean?
That means that it's kind of like Reconstruction over the South.
The
British or the French or the Americans are the true authorities over whatever civilian authorities run it.
But did they run it for those people's interests or their own?
There was let's leave the communists out of this for a second. The people in the West, well, I guess I can kind of make it all true. Each occupation government wanted to rebuild that portion of Germany to reflect the culture of their country because they thought that would keep peace in the future. So obviously all the Western zones are turned into capitalist democracies, and the Eastern zone is turned into a Russian communist dictatorship. and stayed that way.
Why does Russia not want France to have him?
Good question. I think you guys can answer this.
They didn't fight.
In World War One, the Russians left, dropped out and had no voice at Versailles. The French got to take land from Russia to create Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Finland. In World War II, the French drop out very early, but the Russians die by the millions and never quit. So their attitude is France should, like a reverse of World War I, should have no voice over the treaty.
When did that huge Eurasian nation become the USSR?
1917.
Okay.
In the October Revolution.
Did all of the countries that make, or all the republics that...
Supposedly, there were similar Soviet uprisings in each of those republics. Which
right.
Took, yeah. But there, a lot of it's taking the old Russian Empire and just turning it into a now communist empire.
That is supposedly not the new Russian Empire.
They would claim. The liberated people, they claim. War crime trials were held in Nuremberg in 1946, in which the German government officials, judges, and lawmakers and policymakers were all put on trial for heinous war crimes, very specifically the treatment of the Jews. Some have argued that the Nuremberg trials are a violation of... Some have argued that the Nuremberg trials were a violation of ex post facto. What does ex post facto mean?
Creating a law that's effective to things that happened before the law was passed.
Yeah. Let's say that they make a school rule that says it's illegal to wear, or whatever.
Washing.
And they date it back to 3 years ago. So anybody that wore watches this year is in violation of that law and can be punished. That's an ex post facto law.
I think killing millions and millions of people, that was one of those understood laws.
So, in other words, German law did not outlaw the mistreatment. In fact, it allowed the mistreatment of Jewish people. So to punish them for something that was legal to do in the 30s, is that ex post facto?
No, because the Constitution doesn't apply.
Americans did the same
thing. It is, but it should have never been legal anywhere to kill Jewish people.
But then Americans didn't do anything about mistreatment of slaves.
No reparations?
So we're the good moral guides, aren't we?
So I have this one for you. White guy in America that's upset at affirmative action because he never owned any slaves, neither did his parents. Germany's upset about the fact that I never killed any Jews, neither did my parents. Same argument holds for both.
How's the German effect?
Is there not some kind of at least historical cultural responsibility that people should feel?
Or like the German people who like helped hide Jews and things like that, having the...
Or the Underground Railroad you're talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, I when you say like you're just your typical white guy, is that what you mean?
You're pulling a me on me.
Well,
we better get back to the lecture.
What I'm saying is, for the American one, it's been a lot more time.
It has.
As opposed to the...
That's true.
World War, it was less than...
I agree. So in other words, we can duck our responsibility and still blame Germans?
Sure.
Well, that enslavement was more culturally systemic instead of just governmentally systemic. What, systemic?
119,
18. I really get that. Good trials, though. If you really should spend the time watching this, they're showing it right now on OETN. This is one of the classic movies. I'll tell you what. If you are an average high school student who's not that motivated by provocative ideas, you'll be bored. If you're you guys, you'll love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And everybody listening are you guys, so nobody got insulted.
That's only us listening to that.
What that reminds me of, they used to hold after school study sessions for the people who made the lowest grades. Only the A people came.
That's the weirdest
thing I've ever heard. That's the
logical thing, that's a predictable
thing. Before we offend,
119. Winston Churchill. Let's talk about Winston Churchill in 119. As you know, he replaced what prime minister in 1940? Neville Chamberlain. He remained prime minister of England throughout the war. Except, oddly enough, while he's at the Potsdam Conference in July of 1945, he's voted out of office.
Why did he get the boot?
Let's ask this. Why did he get the boot? The boot is this. As long as the country needed to win a war, a hardcore conservative like Churchill was considered needed. Once it was clear that they were going to win the war, they wanted to go back to be concerned with social and economic issues that, that plagued them before the war. Therefore, they went with Labour Party socialist Clement Attlee.
Was Churchill ever re-elected after?
He's going to come back in a minute. I've got to make a Clinton comparison.
Churchill was a conservative?
The Conservative Party. George Bush, when George Bush the Elder won the Gulf War in 1991, his popularity was so high, even among liberal Democrats, that people said the only way Democrats will ever win the next presidency is by nominating Bush.
No, they nominated
So in other words,
Clinton.
Nobody can beat him.
Except Clinton.
But as the war finished and economic concerns started to resurface by 1992 election, economics had replaced foreign policy as the concerns, and no longer was Bush needed instead of Democrat like Clinton was. So some say this, some, not all, that recognizing why his father was not reelected, war policy during the son's administration was timed to not to finish too early before a re-election. That's very cynical to say that, but that's the parallel back to the father and Churchill.
But then it's, what year is it, 2007? Well, what's the point of keeping on going?
He can't get out?
Well, okay.
Well, without causing the whole region to implode into a massive...
Pass it off to a future president.
So we can get another Republican.
Why can't we just do it like
another Republican?
Potentially.
It's described like
but to
that
some ways, I'll criticize Johnson. That's essentially what Johnson did in Vietnam.
The one that has the next president Nixon. Biggest foreign policy screw-ups of the 20th century. First place is invading Iraq. Second place is pulling out too soon.
That's up there.
What?
Churchill. He does get reelected prime minister in 1955. Or 50, is it? 50, 1950. So between 45 and 50, Churchill is not in government, but would like to be. Churchill also wants this. He wants Americans to remember who won World War II.
He did.
FDR and Churchill?
That's what he wants people to remember. Forget about all those millions of Russians. Just think about the Anglo-American alliance that won the war. And important to the Anglo-American alliance is the Anglo part. Which means, don't forget, England is a partner of you and an equal partner, and we want to be considered one of the world dominators instead of a flunky lost empire.
They're a flunky lost empire.
That's really what Churchill wants to do, is to try to keep the importance of England so that America's not just the sole superpower anymore, as well as make himself a remembered important statesman so he can come back to power. In his efforts to do that, he attends Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri in 1946 and makes a famous speech called the Iron Curtain Speech.
An Iron Curtain is descended across.
Yes, in which he says, from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended across Europe. Here's exactly what he's meaning. It's meaning from... this area here, Stettin in the Baltic, down to Trieste in the Adriatic. What he's describing is the fact that all the nations from Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Austria eastward are under Soviet control, and all the nations west are under British American free world control, as we would call it, as we did.
Or their own control.
Is Spain still fascist?
Spain and Portugal remain fascist till the 70s.
God.
And then it comes
but buddies of ours against the communists.
Are they fascist in the jingoistic sense?
No. Okay. They are only in the domestic sense. The Spanish and the Portuguese did not go out conquering. They remained
fascist.
Neutral and stayed that way.
So it divided, the Iron Curtain divided
Europe. Democratic West from Communist East. Or Capitalist West from Communist East. So what's the importance of declaring that there is this division in this Iron Curtain? Why does he say that?
To unite.
Well,
because if there is this great evil, they need to elect someone that can...
That's it. It's to remind people of the West they can't let their guard down, that the Russians are a threat and must be responded to and can't be ignored. As well as to remind people that Britain and America are both doing it together and I could be a good leader of Britain again someday.
Did you say he was reelected in 55?
He was reelected in 50 and lasted till 55. And when the wall came down in 1989, they brought big chunks of the Berlin Wall to this university in commemoration of the Iron Curtain speech. 120 we've done. 121 is really interesting. In 1947, well, you know what year this is? Let's name what countries were under Russian domination after 1945.
Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland.
Yep. I think Finland was free. But
oh, okay.
Yeah, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria. Yugoslavia was under a guy named Tito, who was communist but was not very friendly to the Russians, but it was communist. So what was left in Europe, the only areas east of the Iron Curtain line, was Greece and Turkey. And
how did Greece stay out of?
Well, just out of the war, they were conquered by the Germans during World War II. In 1947, revolutions break out in both Greece and Turkey, and they are communist inspired. So how do we interpret this?
They're spreading communism.
Yes. The Russian threat is starting to grow and emerge. And so in response to that, Congress passes and Truman, Truman announces what's called the Truman Doctrine. And Congress responds with the Greek-Turkish Aid Bill. And the Truman Doctrine, funded by the Congressional Act here, says, well, something to the effect of, can you find it for me? It's better to hear Truman say it. It's something like, wherever there is a danger to democracy in the world, we will respond. Code words for saying, we are willing to now stop the spread of communism. What did the Roosevelt corollary say? Do you recall? We're going to police who?
Western
Hemisphere. The Truman Doctrine has elevated it to the world.
Now, is the Truman Doctrine what's in the Greek-Turkish Aid Bill?
The Greek-Turkish Aid Bill gives funding to support the Truman Doctrine, specifically in helping the Greek and Turkish governments not be overthrown by communist revolution. Do you find it?
We still follow this, too. Well, except in Taiwan. We don't follow this in Taiwan. We're butting up with the Chinese there.
We don't know what time.
I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures.
What a commitment. So any revolution in the world we have to stop now?
Is there an asterisk on that?
It's an understood asterisk. Commie.
Yeah.
It's understood.
Well, it's just like I guess you could call it the Kennedy Doctrine.
I would be like that.
What is it? Assist free peoples
that are
who are in danger of not being free peoples anymore?
Assist, essence. I think you'll recognize it if you hear it and quote it in the test. So if we're Americans, we're declaring we're going to stop the spread of communism through revolution wherever it happens. What if you were Russian?
Like, you wanted to be Russian, not USSR?
Well, I know that this is, it's not good to play devil's advocate here, but is it possible that the Russians could be saying, well, now, here are these people tired of capitalists in Greece and Turkey, and they're finally overthrowing the yoke of capitalism to spread the workers' paradise into these two
did
nations,
you ever give this stuff?
And here's the biggest capitalist country at all, the U.S., preventing uprisings. Nowhere will people ever be able to liberate themselves again because of the giant monster, the USA.
How many people in Greece were the ones who became communist? And were the Russians?
That's good. I can't seriously say in the end of specific Turkey and Greek uprisings how many were on which side. But we gave aid to those governments and they squelched those revolutions.
So.
123.
Whether they wanted it or not, they're democratic.
What about that 122?
Right.
Oh, gosh.
The Marshall Plan? The
Marshall Plan.
How did that disappear? George Marshall was chief of the army through World War II. He wanted to be the one who led the D-Day invasion, but FDR said, I need you at home more so than Eisenhower. You're more valuable to me here. So that's where he stayed. He later became the Secretary of State for Truman during these years in the 1948 period.
This is the Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm. George Marshall proposed this. He said, there's a number of ways that communism spreads. We're primarily thinking militarily here, that when an overthrow or invasion from one nation takes place. But how else does communism spread besides military action?
In economic depressions, and the people themselves form the communist group.
So how could you prevent from that ever happening?
Rebuilding the economy of Europe.
And that's what the Marshall Plan is all about. Or the European Recovery Program, as the birds are singing. He's lecturing. Let's get over there. I didn't want to have to. We have to go do it. Let's bring it on. He's lecturing. The European Recovery...
At least your car's not black.
The European Recovery Program, or the Marshall Plan, spent $14 billion to rebuild the economies of Western European nations so that economic depravity didn't lead to revolutions. The money was also offered to the Russians and to the nations that were under Russian control. But Russia spoke for them and said they don't want it. They don't need it. Some historians have pointed out that the Marshall Plan only went for white Europeans. There was no Marshall Plan to rebuild nations in the Orient that were in danger to Chinese communism.
That's because it's the, well, it's the Marshall Plan.
Well, was the threat of communism so much greater in Europe that that explains it?
Not really. Well, at that point.
Or is taxing people to give money away to other people easier when it's going to white people than yellow?
But what's really the difference between Marxist-Leninist communism and Maoist communism?
The color of the skin of the people who are spreading it. I really do believe the Marshall Plan was accepted because it was for European white people, and a Marshall Plan that would have rebuilt South Korea or Japan, etc., would have been looked upon as, how dare them tax us to spend money on that.
And it could help kind of prevent the Vietnam.
And the other argument could be that the Russian threat in Germany in the 40s was considered much greater than anything going on in the Orient until the Korean War broke out.
Yeah, because they're kind of cutting off the food to Berlin. Yeah.
Well, that's coming up next.
It's going to be random, but what's going on in Africa right now?
If we had a massive Marshall Plan all over the world, the countries that are in economically deprived,
we'd be broke.
We'd be broke, but wouldn't we?
Are we already broke? We deficit.
Being broke is pretty easy to do. Why not? Couldn't we win over certain areas that might be listening to extreme Al Qaeda?
They might be listening to Ho Chi Minh.
I have a question. Mexico, their economy is all bad.
Did we rebuild that?
Well, why aren't they having a socialist uprising?
They constantly deal with that.
They do?
Yeah.
Then why aren't we having a Marshall Plan?
I think it has to do with the color issue again.
Are there enough Mexican immigrants now to where, if, like, by popular demand, we could support our
country? Are you saying that to satisfy that voting public or to keep more Mexican immigrants from coming here?
To satisfy the people who don't want.
Are you saying, couldn't we pass something like that now that so many of our...
Well, not all those people vote.
See those people?
Yeah, they can't vote. But all the people that... do vote, those crazies that vote that don't like those people that can't vote would vote for that to, but then they'll be like, no, we don't want to help those people.
If you could actually seriously prove that a financial foreign aid program to Mexico would reduce illegal immigration
and wouldn't be just lost into corruption of the
yeah
government.
If you could really show statistically that it is going to work, they probably would agree.
Or they would say that, why are you spending all that money
over
there when you could be spending it at home?
If you can't prove it's going to work, then you're giving more and more money to them people. On with this. We're trying to create too much value. Let's get back to memorizing things. Yes, in mid-1948, I'm not sure exactly, I have June down here, but in mid-1948, Stalin closed off access to Berlin, as you pointed out. Berlin sits, so I used to have a map somewhere that showed the division zones, but just picture this. About here is where the line separates East Germany from the rest. This is like was the American zone, this was the French zone, this was the British zone, this all became West Germany, that became all of East Germany. Sitting in the middle of East Germany is Berlin. So to get to Berlin, you had to travel across quite a few hundred miles, multi-hundred miles of Russian-occupied zone.
But there were certain highways and stuff that were...
Yeah, that you were to stay on those highways specifically. Well, those highways were closed off by Stalin in 1948. And his hopes were to make it so if people couldn't get to West Berlin, it just capitulates and all of Berlin becomes part of the Russian-occupied zone. rather than let that happen, they didn't break across and do it on land by militarily. They flew planes regularly for like a year and a half, bringing in food, medicine, clothing, supplies, etc.
Yeah, what could have happened if one of those planes was shot down?
Now, who did the planes?
The U.S. Well, if the Russians had shot down even one plane, it would have been war, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And by 1948, what kind of weaponry did each side have?
Time to make a lot more Russians.
We had atomic bombs. They didn't yet.
Yeah, but there was a couple of them.
So no Russian atomic bombs tested until 1949. We had ours in place by 45. So that may be your explanation why they didn't shoot down planes. After 49, we both had atomic bombs. After 52, we had hydrogen bombs.
And then they had one.
After 54, we both had hydrogen bombs. So that's the escalation.
The only difference is their first hydrogen bomb is one of filling a missile, and ours is the size of a house.
Yeah. Even though they didn't have atomic bombs until 49, I think the truth is nobody wanted to go back into another major war after World War II from 45 to 49.
Now, the East Berlin's in East Germany.
All of Berlin is in East Germany.
Right. So what was Stalin doing?
He was trying to make the West just give up and leave West Berlin completely so that all of Berlin was...
Why did they need him to...
Is the West occupied, West Berlin, not West Germany? Was the West Berlin that's occupied by who?
Same people that occupy West Germany.
Yes.
Okay. So
I was about to say, and still do today, but I forgot that wall came down.
But so Berlin was in East Germany.
The Germans occupied
but
Berlin.
It was,
would it help if we drew a map on the board?
Well... So is that city that's divided in the country also divided?
Yes, that's the...
Okay, that's all I need.
I'm going to draw Germany here.
Maybe he's going to be like Mr. Lincoln and be extremely artistic. I don't know.
This isn't going to look anything like Germany.
Looks a little like Arkansas.
All right, that's close.
East Germany. Originally, there was a British, French, and American zone, but it all in 1949 became the Federated Republic of Germany West. Then here is the Democratic Republic of Germany East, and in there is Berlin, and it was also divided. So to travel across here, that was what was cut off by Stalin, and had to be airlifted.
And that was what the error on the sheet was. It said West Germany FDR instead of FRG. So let's say the Federal Democratic Republic of Germany.
Do I have FDR down?
Yes.
His remains are running for a third in there. Fifth term.
In Germany.
Sorry about that. So that's what's happening in 24.
Okay, what was the... It's not FDR, it's what?
It should be FRD.
FRG.
FR, okay.
Federal Republic of Germany.
Here's a question to ask. What if Stalin had not... Stalin finally capitulated and reopened the highways and we were able to stop the airlifts. What if he never reopened the highways? Would we still be flying planes? Well, we wouldn't be by today because it would fall down.
We would have developed really, really high capacity airplanes by now.
But you can see why with the tensions that occurred.
Why is Berlin? I mean, I'm not
say something more about this.
I'm not trying to downplay Berlin, but why was one city worth flying planes?
It's that old, if you give them an inch here, they'll go on and on. It's you can make that. What's I'll tell you how to answer to this. What's wrong with letting Germany have Austria?
Okay.
How about the Sudetenland? How about the Polish corridor? The German-speaking people, they might stop after that. It's that thinking. The lessons of pre-World War II is you can't let the enemy do it again. And the Russians are thinking the same with us. That's why they were thinking our response to Greece and Turkey is like our response to what they did in Berlin. I forgot to mention something more about this. As these trials got really deep entrenched, the German people were extremely angry at how much embarrassment was being drawn to their Nazi past, and we decided to just close the trials down in a hurry and lighten the sentences so the Germans would be good allies against the Russians. So that's the importance of the Cold War then. In 1949, as I show here...
What's the DRG?
Democratic Republic of Germany.
Okay.
They're the communist people.
So the two Germanies were created, and in 1949, the same year, we created NATO.
And they created Warsaw Pact.
They, by 1955, I left that date out, created the Warsaw Pact. Let's talk about NATO and Warsaw Pact.
When was the Warsaw Pact?
55.
Oh.
How do you do that?
NATO stands for North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Is that like an English-American thing?
Well, it included Canada, ourselves, and 9 Northwestern European nations. It is a what?
It's a mutual defense pact.
How's Washington in his grave thinking about this?
God, Roland.
Yeah. He's spinning.
Why are we deserting? Because you know, if you don't consider the United Nations an alliance, which I think it is, but if you ignore this is the first real military alliance that we entered into that we're still a member of. Why are we ignoring Washington and staying in a long-running military alliance like NATO? That's the Cold War. That's how significant the Cold War was on our thinking.
We were doing everything that we said we wanted because of the Cold War.
Or because of Pearl Harbor. You won't get Pearl Harbor again this time if you stay in something like NATO and make sure you keep West Berlin going and protect the Greek and Turkish governments. That's the thinking is we've gone from isolationism in the 30s to international interventionism in the Cold War period from the lessons learned. And the Russians are thinking the same thing too. So you've got real tensions growing between the two. It's amazing we made it from 1945 up into 1990 without a gigantic huge war breaking out.
Came close a couple times.
So Warsaw is the Russian equivalent.
The Warsaw Pact took the Eastern European countries, not by choice, but by Russian force, into an alliance. So the question was often asked, if a serious war broke out, which way would the Warsaw Pact nations actually march? For the Russians or for the West? 126 takes us out of Europe into problems in the Far East. I need the can, but I don't want you all to run away.
No, we won't.
Don't you need it too?
We can can, but not go places. Just can.
I think I can see that. And it's still got a lot of important things.